rest for the pleasant fields, for the fruitful vine, for the soil of my people, growing up in thorns and briars. Yes, for all the joyous houses in the exultant city. And in the notes, I made a comment that there's a description here of sort of the nation having been attacked. But I'm not really sure, having studied through it again, that it's necessarily an attack as much as it is just the failure of the crops. And it kind of ties into the illustration the prophet used earlier when he talked about the principle of sowing and reaping as it applies to the nation. I guess one thing you might say is that if there is a crop failure, that might explain why the city is abandoned, because there's no food, so people are having to go look for it. Or it may in fact be that in addition to that, or in connection with that, there is an attack because of the language in verse 14. For the palace is forsaken, the populous city deserted, the hill and the watchtower will become dens forever, a joy of wild donkeys, a pasture of flocks. We've seen this language before. We're going to see it again in the lesson tonight, the description of wild animals running amok because a city has been abandoned. So I know I hear some kind of noise in the sound system. Do y'all hear that tonight? It's actually a cricket? Huh. How about that? All right, well, there you go. That'd be great. In fact, I think we'd all love to watch that unfold right now tonight. But it would kind of go right along with this message of judgment we're seeing here in the book. Now, in the notes, I ask you all tonight this question. Why do you think that God singles out the women, the complacent women of Jerusalem, for a warning? And I'll also ask you if you could think of any other passages that are like this in the prophets where women are singled out like this. And, you know, it's like I often say, there's not like there's an answer key back here behind the concordance, right? So this is going to be your best, you know, estimation of why this would be the case. Why in this case would women? We've seen other people singled out, kings, priests, prophets, scribes, the leaders, etc. But here it is, the women. Any ideas? Yeah, Alan? Okay, so one idea would be, you know, they would be, if you think of, like, particularly after invasion, maybe they would be the ones who were left. The one thing that I would say is, though, these are women who are at ease, but, of course, you could say, well, they were at ease until this happened. Yeah, so, yeah, I think that could possibly work. Can you think of any other passages where women are singled out like this in the prophets? Yes, there's a very famous one in the book of Amos. Hear this word, you cows of Bashan, and we'll talk about Bashan here in a minute, who are on the mountains of Samaria, who oppress the poor, who crush the needy, who say to your husbands, bring that we may drink. And then he says, instead, you're going to face the judgment of being led through with fish hooks, which the Assyrians literally did. One idea just may be that, you know, if you think about the women of my granny's generation, particularly who were in poverty like she was in Eastern Kentucky for so long, there's no ease because you don't have any prosperity. It's hard, scratch out a living existence. Or my mom is a single mom who worked two jobs most of, you know, her life, especially when she was bringing me up. I mean, there's just no ease there. So maybe one reason that women are singled out like this is they are women at ease because society is very prosperous. But we know from our study of the prophets that when society is prosperous, what tends to happen to the spiritual condition of the people? Yeah, so that might be the reason why. I would also remind you, if you hold your place here and go back earlier in the book to chapter 3, he does mention women earlier in the book and it seems again to be associated with excessive prosperity. In chapter 3, verse 16, the Lord said, because the daughters of Zion are haughty and walk with outstretched necks, glancing wantonly with their eyes, mincing along as they go, tinkling with their feet. Therefore, the Lord will strike with a scab the heads of the daughters of Zion. So that would be one guess also, is that maybe women at ease reflect a society of, you know, great opulence, prosperity, which tends to be a spiritual negative for the people. Certainly they're not singled out like the men are typically in this book, but I did think that it was interesting to make note of that. Now, if you go on here, verse 11, I'm sorry, yeah, Tommy. Sackcloth. Okay. Sackcloth. Tommy's asking, what is sackcloth? I guess the be like burlap, burlap sack in our culture. And it was the typical clothing to designate sorrowful repentance, where the expression sackcloth and ashes comes from. So that would be the idea here, is that instead of being at ease and all decked out in your prosperity, you're going to have a wardrobe change, and it's going to be sackcloth because of the sorrow over what's going to befall the nation here. Yeah. Now then, the reason I picked this picture is because rather than emphasize the negative note, I wanted to emphasize the positive note, which is, and we see this a lot, right? In Isaiah, we're used to this now. He just turns on a dime from these messages of judgment to hope, or hope to judgment. So verse 15, this will be the case until when? The Spirit is poured out from on high. And this is an image that's found a lot in the Bible, the Spirit like water being poured out. And the wilderness becomes a fruitful field, and the fruitful field is deemed a forest. Then justice will dwell in the wilderness, and righteousness abide in the fruitful field. And the effect of righteousness will be peace, and the result of righteousness, quietness and trust forever. My people will abide in a peaceful habitation, in secure dwellings, and in quiet resting places. Now I ask you, if you were able to look ahead tonight, can you think of a couple of other passages that promise this outpouring of the Spirit? Even you don't necessarily have to have the book, chapter, and verse, but at least roughly that, at least the idea. Can you think of any? Very good. That's exactly right. So in Acts 2, Peter says, this outpouring of the Spirit that you're seeing is what was spoken of by the prophet Joel. And it shall come to pass afterward that I will pour out of my Spirit on all flesh, and your sons and daughters will prophesy, and so forth. And then also included Ezekiel 36:27, I will put my Spirit within you. I don't want to make a lot of hay about this point here, because I've said this many, 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 many times in other classes, although it's been a while since I've brought this point up. If we don't recognize the coming of the Spirit as significant, we won't fully understand why the new covenant is a new covenant. The new covenant is not just an exchange of one set of rules for another. It's a much bigger thing than that. And part of what makes the new covenant is God gives the Spirit to help people keep his word. And that's what all of these passages and many more are pointing us to. But just wanted to remind you of these two here in Ezekiel and also in Joel. All right, that gets us up through the end of chapter 32. Any questions or comments before we move on? We've got to get through the end of 35 tonight. So we got to hustle a little bit. These are not huge chapters, but we do have to be expeditious. So, all right, let's go on in here into chapter 33. What's the first word? Whoa, right, or ah, which is bad, but yes. So this is the last one. This is number 6. Ah, or woe, you destroyer, who yourself have not been destroyed, you traitor whom none has betrayed. When you have ceased to destroy, you will be destroyed. And when you have finished betraying, they will betray you. Now, he doesn't mention who this is here, but given the overall historical backdrop of the first part of Isaiah, who would you reckon is under discussion here? Yeah, the Assyrians. Those are the bad guys that are hovering through most of chapters 1 through 39. And in fact, the reference to treachery here, to betrayal, which you see at the end of verse 1, middle and end of verse 1, A lot of people think specifically has in mind something that is described for us in 2 Kings 18. So hold your place here and look with me over in 2 Kings chapter 18. Now, remember, where we are headed to end the first half of Isaiah is a historical section that covers 36, 7, 8, and 9. That's how the first half of the book ends. And it has to do with the Assyrian crisis when it comes to a head, and this is a part of what we're reading about here in 2 Kings chapter 18. So notice in verse 1, in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, he's one of the kings that we're going to read about, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah and took them. And Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria at Lachish. By the way, a lot of our old guard Florida College Bible faculty folks, when giants roam the earth, like Farrell Jenkins and Phil Roberts and Melvin Curry, they went and worked at this dig. And I think some of you know the Chandler family, like you know the Chandler family. Luke Chandler still goes over to Lachish periodically and digs. So Hezekiah says, I've done wrong. Withdraw from me. Whatever you impose on me, I will bear. The king of Assyria required of Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver, 30 talents of gold. Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the house of the Lord in the treasuries of the king's house. And then notice, what is the king of Assyria's response after he pays tribute in verse 17? The king of Assyria sent the Tartan, the Rabsaris, and the Rabshaka with a great army from Lachish to King Hezekiah, Jerusalem. So this is not your money or your life. This is your money and your life. I take your money, and then I'm going to invade anyway. So it's that betrayal, that treachery, that a lot of the commentators think is in mind here, back over in Isaiah chapter 33. Lots more to talk about that whole era, Lord willing, on Sunday when we get to those chapters. Now then, if you go back to 33 and verse 2, do you recall, I've said to you many, many times, the fundamental issue in chapters 1 through 39 of Isaiah is who will the people trust or follow? That's exactly right. The nations or God? Now, in this instance, notice in verse 2, who are the people now trusting in? O Lord, be gracious to us, we wait for you. Be our arm every morning, our salvation in the time of trouble. At the tumultuous noise, peoples flee. When you lift yourself up, nations are scattered, and your spoil is gathered as the caterpillar gathers, as locusts leap, it is leapt upon. So they were going to take away our stuff, and now you drive them away, and we can go peacefully, easily get it back. Verse 5, the Lord is exalted, for he dwells on high. He will fill Zion with justice and righteousness, and he will be the stability of your times, abundance of salvation, wisdom, and knowledge. And then I love this last line of verse 6. This is great. The fear of the Lord is what? Zion's treasure. Isn't that great? That's what their treasure is. Not the treasure we're going to go send to the king of Assyria to pay him off. That which we should value above all else is the fear of the Lord. Now then, notice in verse 7, the scene shifts, and it describes the plight of the people when they're trying to carry out all of these, you know, backroom dealings. Behold, their heroes cry in the streets, the envoys of peace weep bitterly. The highways lie waste, the traveler ceases, covenants are broken, cities are despised, there is no regard for man, the land mourns and languishes. And then it mentions several regions here. Lebanon is confounded and withers away. Sharon is like a desert. Bashan and Carmel shake off their leaves. That doesn't look good on my screen. What does this look like to you all? Let me go down here, take a look. Can you all make out any of those words, or are they just blending into the green? Can you all see anything back here? Darren, I'll come back here and see what it looks like. Oh, it looks pretty good right there. All right, now, in case, let's see how far this, oh, look at that. I could just sit back here and teach this class the whole time. This is fantastic. All right, so there's Bashan, which we've already talked about from that prophecy in Amos. Up here is the region of Lebanon. Right here, you can always identify Mount Carmel. It's the thumb sticking out here. And the plain that extends from Mount Carmel down here is the plain of Sharon. This is the plain of Phoenicia. Down here is the plain of Philistia, but right here is the plain of Sharon. And then, of course, right here is Mount Carmel. Now, if you know nothing else at all about this region, just by looking at the color scheme, what do you know about the vegetation and the fertility of this region? A lot of green, right? And that's the point. As a matter of fact, these regions here are all regions that are famous, proverbial, for their, you know, lush vegetation. We already know, for example, that Lebanon, the cedars of Lebanon, you know, that's where the cedars come from, and so forth. And the point is then, if you go back and look at these verses, these are parts of the nation that are famous for their, you know, lushness. But instead now, because of the threat of the enemy, it's mourning, it's languishing, it withers away, and so forth, until the Lord helps. So we got this back and forth, and it's confusing, unless you're really used to this kind of stuff, how he goes back and forth so easily from, hey, the betrayer's going to get it, we're going to rejoice, oh, things are terrible, and oh, the Lord's going to help us. But by now, it should be old school for all of us. So verse 10. He says, now I will arise, says the Lord. Now I will lift myself up. Now I will be exalted. And then presumably he says this to the Assyrians. You conceive chaff. You give birth to stubble. Which is a very evocative way of saying all of your plans are going to amount to nothing. Your breath is a fire that will consume you. And the peoples will be as if burned to lime, like thorns cut down that are burned in the fire. And so the Lord is promising here that he will arise, and as a result of his mighty actions, even those who are far off will acknowledge him. So verse 13, hear you who are far off what I've done, and you who are near, acknowledge my might. The sinners in Zion are afraid. Trembling has seized the godless. Who among us can dwell with the consuming fire? Who among us can dwell with everlasting burnings? And if you think about it, who are they talking about? Who or what are they describing as the consuming fire? The book of Hebrews can help you out. Our God is a consuming fire. So here's what they're asking. All right, if God is going to act, well, we're sinful people. How could we possibly dwell in the holy city where God is, knowing how sinful we are? Which should remind you of a scene much earlier in this book that I call you back to almost every class, when the prophet Isaiah sees God high and exalted, holy, 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 and his immediate reaction is, woe is me, a man of unclean lips, among a people of unclean lips. But then God purifies him, and then he can say, now I can serve you. So if you will change your character, you can live with God. So verse 15, here's who can dwell with the consuming fire. He who walks righteously and speaks uprightly, who despises the gain of oppressors, who shakes his hands lest they hold a bribe, who stops his ears from hearing of bloodshed and shuts his eyes from looking on evil. We've seen this many times in the book of Isaiah. By now we know the fundamental social sin is the sin of wealthy oppressors taking advantage of the poor or the widow or the sojourner, particularly in legal courts. But the person who rejects that and lives righteously, he, verse 16, will dwell on the heights. His place of defense will be the fortress of rocks. His bread will be given him. His water will be sure. Now, in the notes, I ask you to consider this description of who can dwell with the Lord with this description of the king back in Isaiah 11. So remember, we've got a section of Isaiah that sometimes is called the Book of Emmanuel. Chapter 7, that's the Emmanuel prophecy. Chapter 9, that's the a child will be given, a son will be born, and upon his shoulders will be the government, and he shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. And then chapter 11 says the Spirit will be given to him, a spirit of wisdom and understanding. And notice the similarity in the description in Isaiah of who can dwell with God and the description of the king in Isaiah 11. Very similar, right? In chapter 11, his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. Remember, that's what we just learned. That's the treasure of Zion, is the fear of the Lord. He shall not judge by what his eyes see, decide disputes by what his ears hear. Remember, it said in chapter 34, he stops his ears from hearing bloodshed, his eyes from looking on evil. And then instead, he will judge with righteousness. So the point is, you can dwell with God and the king if you become like them. Become like them, you can live with them. That's the story of the Bible. That's what the whole point is for us to be made like God. That's how we were originally made in his image. Sin corrupts that, but redemption enables us to be renewed after the pattern of Jesus Christ and become more and more like him. Some of you old timers may remember a few years ago, our congregational theme was Christ in you, the hope of glory. And that's the essence of what it is to be a Christian. Christ in you, becoming like him, and then ultimately having this hope of glory. So beautiful, beautiful promise here, a reminder of what the message of the Bible is all about. All right, any questions or comments up through verse 16? All right, we'll just plunge right on here. So we're going to finish this chapter out here. So then, verse 17, your eyes will behold the king in his beauty, which is a phrase that appears in our hymnals. Beautiful phrase. Because we're like him, we will see him. They will see a land that stretches afar. Your heart will muse on the terror. Where is he who counted? Where is he who weighed the tribute? Where is he who counted the towers? You see the idea here? The Assyrians, they're counting up all that tribute that was paid. Then they come and besiege. They're counting up all the towers, making their plans to invade. They're counting up all of this effort to take advantage of the people of Jerusalem and invade. Verse 19, you will see no more the insolent people, the people of an obscure speech, the foreign language of the Assyrians. You cannot comprehend, stammering in a tongue you cannot understand. Don't have to worry about these people anymore. Instead, behold Zion, verse 20, the city of our appointed feasts. Your eyes will see Jerusalem, an untroubled habitation. And then this is a really interesting word picture. An immovable tent. Now, your preacher just said that's an interesting picture. You may think, I don't find it the least bit interesting. But at least it's a curious picture. Why is it a curious picture? Exactly. Tents are designed to be movable. But maybe the point here is God is so powerful, he can make strong so forcefully that he can even make that which under normal circumstances is temporary, he can make it permanent. An immovable tent whose stakes will never be plucked up, nor will any of its cords will be broken. In our own nature as mortal human beings, we are easily plucked up. But with God helping us, he can make sure that won't happen. Verse 21, there the Lord in majesty will be for us a place of broad rivers and streams. And this is kind of curious, to my reading at least, where no galley with oars. So do y'all have in your mind like those old movies like Ben-Hur or, you know, Julius Caesar, Caesar and Cleopatra, those gigantic galleys with all the slaves pulling the oars, which are obviously made for the seas, for the ocean, not for rivers and streams. So those would be vessels that you would use to invade. So if the point here is there will not be any galleys with oars, the point is we don't have to worry about foreign invasion. See, that's the idea. For the Lord, verse 22, is our judge. The Lord is our lawgiver. The Lord is our king. And so now we know in verse 17 who the king in his beauty is. It is the Lord. And so we can dwell with him if we are made like him, which, by the way, is the theme of everybody's favorite book of the Bible, Leviticus, right? Leviticus has a recurrent frame. You shall be as I am. You shall be holy as I am holy. And then the book proceeds to show us in two sections how to be made holy through the sacrificial system, and then how to live holy through all those laws and everything in the second half of the book. But this is really, in many respects, it is the theme of the Bible itself. And then most commentators take, and it seems to me this makes a lot of sense, the last couple of verses refer to, verse 23 at least, refers to the Assyrian plans, which may be compared to a big ship but are going to be to no avail. Verse 23, your cords hang loose. They cannot hold the mast firm in its place or keep the sail spread out. Then prey and spoil in abundance will be divided. Even the lame will take prey. You thought you were going to take prey. You're nothing now. And all the stuff you stole, we can easily get back. No inhabitant will say, I am sick. Theme alert, theme alert, theme alert. We haven't gotten to it yet, but we're going to, and we're going to use this passage and a bunch of others from Isaiah with healing in his wings, and the people who dwell there will be forgiven their iniquity. All right, y'all doing good? Maybe we've made our way up through 33. We've got two more chapters. Think we can do it in 14 minutes? I think we can do it because chapter 35 is pretty short. So any questions, though? Don't hesitate to make questions or comments. We can always make time up if we need to somewhere. All right, so we're going to go right on ahead here. So chapter 34 and 35 are like mirror images of each other. And here's the way to think about them. Chapter 34 is going to be about a desert. And it's going to show, here's what happens to the wicked. They're going to be wiped out. It's going to look like a desert, like Sodom and Gomorrah. Chapter 35 is going to be a beautiful, lush wilderness. And that's going to show us what happens when you trust in God. All right, so chapter 34 starts off a lot like chapter 13, chapter 24. Remember when we were in the section of judgments against the nations? Starts off a lot like that. So chapter 34, verse 1, draw near, O nations, to hear. Give attention, O peoples. Let the earth hear and all that fills it, the world and all that comes from it. For the Lord is enraged against all the nations and furious against all their host. He has devoted them to destruction. He's given them over for slaughter. Now that phraseology, devoted them to destruction, particularly for some of you ladies and gentlemen who've just gone through the history and geography of the Old Testament, this phrase should ring a bell. Where is this phrase used in the Old Testament? Devoted to destruction. In Hebrew, it's the word cherem. That made it all clear, right? Oh, yeah, that word, devoted to destruction. All right, what city did Israel conquer and they weren't supposed to take stuff? Jericho, that's right. They're not supposed to take stuff. And somebody took stuff, and that was Achan, right? And then they lost the battle of Ai at first, and then they found out that it was Achan, and then they stoned him, and then he was really Achan. That's the kind of humor you would get if I was teaching your freshman Bible class right there. All right, so the reason they weren't supposed to take any stuff from Jericho is because Jericho was cherem, devoted to destruction. There's only a few instances of this in the Bible when God says a place is so wicked, everything is to be destroyed, and it's going to be like it's a burnt offering to me. In other words, you don't get any plunder, you don't get any of the spoils of victory. Well, that's the language that's now being used, and we're going to see this concept repeated here in this section. So verse 3, their slain shall be cast out, the stench of their corpses shall rise. This is definitely a PG-13 chapter here in the Bible, all right, for violence. The mountains shall flow with their blood. All the hosts of heaven shall rot away. The skies roll up like a scroll. All the hosts shall fall. We've seen this language a couple of times now, right? And you're familiar now if I say decreation or reversal of creation. That's the language of judgment often in the Bible. Now then, in verse 5, this language of judgment against the entire world is now brought into sharp focus and directed at one nation in particular as a sample of this worldwide judgment. And who is that nation? Edom. Why do you think, and again, it's an open-ended question here, why Edom as a representative? Who is the fountainhead of Edom? Esau. And he certainly becomes proverbial in the Bible for wickedness. He comes up in the book of Hebrews, for example. He's also found in non-biblical Jewish literature. As a matter of fact, one of Brother Homer Haley's, can y'all even read the writing? Okay, there's a difference here in our screens. One of the last books Brother Haley wrote, he did an entire...
I couldn't hear what you said.
Sorry, Siri is talking to me. Siri is... I hope y'all didn't hear what Siri just called me here. My name is Galactic Overlord, and you're not supposed to hear that when it comes up. So I'm not sure how that happened there. So one of the last books that Brother Haley wrote is a book in which he just traced through the Bible this theme here of the Edomites as a symbol of the nations of the world. And that is what the prophet here is doing. And again, this is stout language. Verse 6, the Lord has a sword. It is, oh, by the way, notice at the end of verse 5, I've devoted to destruction. There's that language again. Verse 6, the Lord has a sword. It is sated with blood, gorged with fat, with the blood of lambs and goats, the fat of the kidneys. But as soon as you hear that, you know this is language coming from the sacrificial system, because that's really the only place in the Bible where you read about fat of kidneys, you know. It's the idea of these people are so wicked. I don't want you to be contaminated with any of their stuff. It's all just going to go to me in terms of this judgment. Verse 8, for the Lord has a day of vengeance, a year of recompense for the cause of Zion. And then here's the language of Sodom and Gomorrah. The streams of Edom shall be turned into pitch, her soil into sulfur, her land shall become a burning pitch. Night and day it shall not be quenched. Its smoke shall go up forever. From generation to generation it shall lie waste. None shall pass through it forever. And then there's a bunch of animals listed starting at verse 11, then down in verse 13. And by the way, I'm not going to read them because we don't know actually what some of these animals are. And your Bible may even have a footnote to that effect. The Hebrew here is uncertain. Translators take their best shot at trying to determine what they are. The one thing I will say is at least the ones that are named in verse 11 are all unclean animals. And a lot of times the reason animals are unclean is because they're scavenger type animals. And then you'll notice our old friends in verse 13, jackals and ostriches, or maybe owls. Your Bible may say owls. And then wild animals like the wild goat. We saw these back in chapter 13 in a similar context. Back in chapter 13, the fall of Babylon, when Babylon falls, then all of these wild scavenger animals, that's all that's going to be left. So this is a, you know, very descriptive, sorry, I fast-forwarded a little bit, very descriptive picture of the judgment that's going to fall upon the world. And I realize, for our culture especially, when you read this language, which is so graphic and so violent, it is definitely tough stuff. And one thing I will say about this is, when you are dealing with great wickedness that is powerful, when God judges it, it's not going to be a pretty picture because it's powerful and it's wicked. So when God liberates Israel from slavery, there is a lot of death, mayhem, and destruction that takes place. But it's because there were powerful forces who were utterly defiant of God and who were violent and who were wicked. So to overthrow them, it's not going to be a pretty picture. But it is a testimony to human sinfulness and stubbornness and depravity when you see that this kind of picture takes place here. But in any event, that gets us up through verse 17. The destruction that's going to befall Edom as a symbol of the wickedness of the nations who have persecuted, attacked God's people. All right. So then, let's end on a high note. So remember I said 34 and 35 are like mirror images. So 34, the wicked are going to be destroyed and it's going to look like a burnt out desert. Now, in chapter 35, the righteous will be blessed and it's going to be like a desert that's made glorious. So the wilderness and dry land shall be glad. The desert shall rejoice, the blossom like the crocus. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice with joy and singing. And then remember those areas that we looked at on the map that are, you know, synonymous with fertility that were going to be waylaid. Well, guess what's going to happen to them? The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it, the majesty of Carmel and Sharon. They shall see the glory of the Lord, the majesty of our God. And then, theme alert, verse 3, strengthen the weak hands and make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who have an anxious heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. With the recompense of God, he will come and save you. And then, remember from Isaiah 6, what did Isaiah learn about the people he was going to preach to? They have eyes but can't see, ears but can't hear. Verse 5, then the eyes of the blind shall be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap like a deer and the tongue of the mute sing for joy. Now, when you read that in connection with all of these references in Isaiah to sin as a sickness or a debilitating lameness, then you can see that there are many layers of meaning here to a prophecy like this. I would, though, point you to this passage. Remember when John the Baptist was in prison, he sent messengers to Jesus to ask a question. What was the question? Are you the expected one, or should we look for another? And Jesus says to them, I want you to go back and tell John what you've seen. And what have they seen? So here's the passage. It says, he answered them, go and tell John what you've seen and heard. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, the poor have the good news. It's kind of a medley of a couple of places in the Old Testament. And so what Jesus is saying is, this passage is a description of what it will look like when the Messiah comes. So you can go tell John, this is the stuff that I'm doing. Now, I'm not, you know, incinerating the Roman centurions and all the armies, and I haven't wiped out Caesar, and I haven't broken you out of prison either. But I am doing these things. And that should show you that it may not be the way you expected it to go down, John, but this is what the prophet said would happen here. And that's this beautiful passage we've just read here in Isaiah chapter 35. So if you go back now to chapter 35, I stopped in the middle of verse 6. So let me finish verse 6. The waters break forth in the wilderness, streams in the desert. The burning sand shall become a pool, the thirsty ground springs of water. In the haunt of jackals, where they lie down, the grass shall become reeds and rushes. The absolute reversal of chapter 34. So that's why a lot of commentators say it's like a mirror image of 34 to 35. And then we've got a figure of speech here, an image that we've seen several times already. And what is that image? A highway. That's right.
I couldn't hear what you said.
I don't know what's going on tonight with this contraption here. So a highway will be there, and it shall be called the Way of Holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it. It shall belong to those who walk on the way. Even if they are fools, they shall not go astray. That's the kind of road I need, because I get lost all the time. So I need that. Ever since we've been in this new building on Wednesday nights, I almost always pass the entrance. And I almost did it again tonight. And if there's somebody right behind me, just pray for me, all right? So this is the kind of roadway that I need right here. And then verse 9, no lion shall be there, nor shall any ravenous beast come upon it. They shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there. And the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. Beautiful, beautiful chapter. Just the exact opposite of chapter 34. And in some ways, it would be a great high note to end on for the first half of the book. But we have to understand how we get from the first half of the book, which is about the Assyrian crisis, to the second half of the book, which looks forward to the Babylonian crisis. And that's what the next section is designed to do. 36 through 39 are going to transition us by explaining to us how the Assyrian crisis shakes out, and then also transitions us at the end of 39 to the Babylonian crisis, which we'll see. All right, guys, thank you all so much. We had this is the challenge of a large book, but congratulations, you are now over halfway through the book of Isaiah. And Lord willing, on Sunday, we'll look at that historical section.